You're listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, this is William Fink of Christogenia.org, and this is Christogenia Internet Radio. This program is being pre-recorded for Friday, January 16th, 2026. I have to think about the year now. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thank you for listening. This evening, we have Sven Longshanks here with us. And I may have another guest later that's indetermined, so I might adjust this introduction if I do, and if I don't, then you're going to hear this. Sven Longshanks is recently released from prison and out from under supervision and some of the restrictions he had, where he couldn't use the internet for quite some time. I think it was 6 months. Sven might correct me on that, but it was thereabouts anyway. He spent several years in prison in Britain for things that he said online, not things that he said online at Christogenia, but things he said online in other podcasts that he did, speaking about politics and the political and social situation in Britain itself. I'd love to hear from him about that this afternoon, and I think it'll be valuable to our community because eventually we all may be faced with this at the rate that the Zionist Jews are really trying to suppress our freedom of expression. Sven, thank you for being here. It's great to see you.
Thanks, Bill. Yeah, I'm really pleased to be back on again. It's been quite a few years, I think, since we made a podcast together. And it was really a boost to me after I came out of prison and I hadn't listened to any podcasts for, I think, probably about 9 months. And then when I was finally out of the hostel, I thought I was sort of safe enough to start listening to your podcasts again. And I got someone to download them for me and put them on a USB stick so I wasn't breaking my license conditions. And then I was able to pick up where I left off, which was at the beginning of the Genesis series. And I really enjoyed that. It was really good to hear your voice again. And it really felt like I was sort of back in the real world again, instead of being stuck there in the prison world. So it was really good just to hear your voice and to hear such an excellent series as well. I really did enjoy that. And I've been off license now for 2 months, 3 months, something like that. I was in prison for 1 year and 3 months, and then I was on license for 1 year and 3 months. So I was basically not allowed to post anything on the internet for 2.5 years. And they were extremely strict with these license conditions. When I first came out, I wasn't even allowed to go on Amazon and do any shopping. And that lasted for quite a few months. And then they relented a bit. And at first they allowed me to download some music. Then I was able to let other people have my email address. But it wasn't until about 2 or 3 months before the end of my license period that I was able to start putting other people on my Teams account. In fact, I wasn't even allowed a Teams account until after the changeover from Skype to Teams. And I wasn't allowed to use Telegram. So I was really sort of cut off from communications with my support network, even more so than when I was in prison. Because when I was in prison, I was able to give people the prison address. They were able to write to me. They were able to email me. And in the last prison I was at, I even had a laptop in my cell. Of course, it wasn't connected to the internet, but I could do my banking on there. I could buy things from the prison canteen and I could read emails that had been sent to me and return these emails. But when I came out and I was on license, I was in a probation hostel. And of course, you can't really make the address of that public, because it could be a risk for other people that are in that hostel, as well as for myself. So I wasn't able to then even give an address to people. So I was really sort of cut off from communication, more so when I was actually out of the prison than when I was in the prison. And it was quite an experience. And people have asked me how my faith was through this. And really, it was just all put in God's hands. I mean, once I was in there, I was like, well, this is obviously what's meant to happen. and I've just got to put my trust in God that this is what's meant to happen, and everything will be all right. And everything was all right. It could have been a lot worse than it actually was. So I'm very thankful for that. And I did feel as if God was looking after me the whole time. And I was put in there basically for speaking the truth, but using what I guess you would refer to as offensive language when I was actually speaking the truth. I was using old-fashioned English, which a jury decided was insulting, abusive, or threatening to minorities, which is why they found me guilty. They found me guilty on 10 podcasts out of 15. And that's what it means in incitement to hate. We know the dictionary definition of hate is sort of uncontrollable disgust towards people. And that's not actually what they go on. It's the term hateful. If you're going to be hateful about someone, it means you're going to say something insulting, threatening, or abusive. So their bar for deciding whether somebody is guilty of incitement to hate or not is whether a jury thinks that what you said was abusive, threatening, or insulting. And years ago, it used to be absolutely fine to abbreviate the word Pakistani, and it wasn't seen as offensive. But today, it is seen as insulting to abbreviate the term Pakistani. And that was the sort of thing that I was doing. That was one example of it, which I thought I would be okay with. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. We're not allowed to say that. That's considered insulting in Britain to say that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I'm sorry. That's crazy.
I was referring to the London mayor as that as well. So they said that was clearly insulting to the mayor of London. Clearly,
so was Brit insulting?
Well, exactly. It's just abbreviating a word. I think they just pick and choose these terms. Terms which were absolutely fine years ago. I mean, I didn't use the N-word, but there was a cartoon with the N-word blanked out, and they made a big thing about that. They made a big thing about that it was used in a punk song that I played, which they said was threatening. But if you go back years ago, if you look at the Dam Busters, they had a pet dog in the Dam Busters, and the pet dog was called the N-word. And it wasn't called that word because they hated the dog. I mean, it was a pet dog. It was obviously they were very fond of this dog. And the word that they chose to call that dog, obviously it wasn't a hateful word to them back then, but it's now considered insulting. And I think that just really shows you that words which could be quite normal in use 20 years ago, 30 years ago, nowadays we have these ridiculous speech codes which mean that you're just not allowed to use them. And if what they say is correct, because they say that, well, if you start using these words, then you're more likely to go on to carry out terrorist acts. Well, if that's true, then the biggest terrorist community in Britain will be the old people, because everybody over the age of 70 or 80 just uses these terms because they are used to using them from when they were younger, and they weren't seen as an insult. And quite clearly, they don't mean it as an insult. But of course, they don't go after the elderly for using these terms. What they do is they go after political commentators like myself, because the whole point of it is to silence people, is to create a chilling effect on people so they don't talk about these issues. That's the point of it.
This idea that you can't insult anybody, it is also totally slanted. I mean, when I walk down any street in America and I see a gay pride flag, as a Christian man, I'm insulted and I'm offended by that. But I can ignore it, and I have to ignore it.
Nice.
You should be able to insult people, and they should have to ignore it. I'm insulted by this society and offended by it every day. Every day I leave my house, at least. Or every day I go on Twitter, on X, or on Facebook. I see things that are insulting, that are denigrating to my values, that are offensive to me, that I have to ignore and recognize that those people have the freedom of expression to say those things. I was talking to my son the other night, and we were talking about some of the way that news announcers in America started pronouncing the names of foreign countries just a few years ago, or at least a decade or two ago. When Chile comes up, they say Chile on the news announcement. Chile, they pronounce it like the people do in Chile. They try to imitate that. But when Germany comes up, they don't say Deutschland. When Poland comes up, they don't say Polska, or however the Polish say that. But they say Chile. So it's okay when you're talking about a non-white nation to use the non-white indigenous pronunciations of their countries. But when you're talking about a white nation, it's just Germany or Poland or Ireland. It's not Deutschland or Polska or something like that. It's totally hypocritical. Liberalism is 100% hypocritical. So how do we understand how to navigate their hypocrisy? It's difficult.
Yes, double standards. It really is double standards. I mean, I think you can still talk about these issues that we talk about. It's just that you have to be careful with the sort of terminology that you use when doing it. I mean, it's part of the human rights. You have a human right to your beliefs, and they're not allowed to try to change your beliefs. And that means political belief. So it's not the fact that the political belief in itself can be illegal, but the way you express that political belief, that can make it illegal. So you could be talking about immigration statistics, and so long as you talk about it in a certain way, then it's legal. But if you talk about it in another way, then it could be illegal, even though it's exactly the same statistics. And further than that, even if you've got completely legal statistics, and say you are giving out leaflets with these statistics on, saying, for instance, white people in Britain are predicted to be a minority by 2060, and then you put the source for that, that's absolutely fine. But if you get arrested by the police and they go through your social media accounts, and if on your social media accounts they find you abbreviating the word Pakistani or saying other terms that could be considered racial slurs, then that changes things. Then it will be said in a court that you intended to incite hate by handing out those leaflets. And their proof that you intended to incite hate was that you used hateful words in your social media for minorities. So even though the statistics are completely legal, something that you do in a completely other sphere, like your social media accounts, that can be used as evidence against you. So if people are in Britain and they are getting involved in activism and they are doing leafleting, which I do advise people to do, get involved in activism, but also make certain that you don't use any racial slurs in your comments and in your social media, and then you'll be safe, basically. So long as you're not using insulting, threatening or abusive terms for minorities, then you should be safe to discuss these things. It's like an added hurdle that you've got to get over to sort of get to the goal. And I guess you could look at it and just say, well, it makes things a little bit more interesting, doesn't it?
It seems to me that they're just making up rules on the fly in order to silence dissent,
yeah.
Period.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. I haven't watched television for years, and when I was in prison, you just have a television set in every cell, so you start watching television again. And they had The Simpsons on, and it was about 25 years old. And in The Simpsons, they used one of the words that I was told was insulting, threatening or abusive during the trial. And yet it was even on The Simpsons. There's a TV program called Shameless, which is about people living on a council estate that are all on benefits. It was written in the 90s by a very, very left-wing scriptwriter. And the language in that was worse than the language that I was using in this on my podcasts. But the difference between me and The Simpsons are the people that write The Simpsons are left-wing establishment types, and their politics are left-wing. The difference with me is my politics are right-wing. My politics are nationalist. Therefore, even using the same words that they were using, I would get prosecuted for it because of my politics. And that proves that it's a political prosecution. And it's used to silence people talking about certain political views because they can't ban the belief outright. So they just make it more and more difficult for you to express that belief. But there you go. It just makes things more interesting, really. Adds a certain layer of difficulty to it. And that's all you can really say about
it. Did you raise any of these issues? I mean, they're probably difficult to conceive them all ahead of time, but did you?
Well, I wasn't able to raise the television ones because I hadn't watched television for so long. If I had been watching television, then I would have definitely have brought those up. I would have said, look, this is exactly the same word that I'm using, and it's there on mainstream television. So therefore, it shows you that I didn't mean it as an insult. It was just old-fashioned English that I was using. I gave a very good defence. There were 15 charges against me, and they put me up against the King's own barrister, the Silk, they're called, the best barristers in the country. And they put me up against him, and I was on the stand for 4 days, 5 days, being cross-examined by him. And I beat him on 5, and I lost on 10, which I was very pleased that I did beat him on 5 of these charges. And there was one person in the jury who said I was not guilty all the way through. And there was another person that said I was not guilty on 5 of them. It might have even been more. I think it might have even been unanimous on some of the ones that I was found not guilty on. And they took a majority verdict. If they had did it the old way and said, if there's anybody that has any doubts about this, you mustn't convict this man, then I wouldn't have been convicted. But they had to accept a majority verdict, basically. But I was very pleased with the.
How did they change that?
Well, they changed that in the 60s when they did away with the death sentence. They also did away with the having to have a unanimous jury in order to sentence somebody. Years ago, they used to say, well, it was more important that we don't have an innocent man in prison. It's better to let a guilty man go free than put an innocent man in prison. And that was the mentality. And now the mentality is, no, it's better that we have a few innocent people go to prison than a guilty person not go to prison. I think that's the way that they look at it now. It's wrong. It really is wrong, because if there is any
that's a fundamental doubt, change in the way a nation looks at its law and decides who, that's a really fundamental change. I mean, that's a huge shift. In America, for instance, it's kind of rigged that way in cases such as my own, where I was tried under civil rights violations, right? But those civil rights violations have criminal penalties. So when it comes down to guilt or innocence, the standard that they use is the civil standard, which is a majority or a certain majority. And then you face a criminal penalty, even though you were tried by a civil standard. And that's criminal as far as I'm concerned. Doing that is wrong. But if all criminal cases were tried like that, that's a major fundamental shift in the way that we look at law and evaluate who's a criminal and who's not. And then we can't, that basically nullifies jury nullification, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, I don't think we could do that over here. We can't say, oh, we don't want that person on the jury. I don't think we get the chance to do that over here. But what they're trying to do now, the current administration in Britain wants to do away with jury trials outright. They've said only if you're going to be sentenced to more than 4 years in prison can you have a jury trial. And there's lots of pushback against this because it goes against the most fundamental rights that we have in Britain. It goes against the Magna Carta, the right to be tried by a jury of your peers. And they're now talking about getting rid of that. And of course, what that will mean is if you've got people on speech offences, then they won't even be seen by a jury. You'll have a politically appointed judge who will be left wing. That's why he will have been made into a judge or a magistrate. And he will just find people guilty. They sort of assume that if you've been charged, then you must be guilty. I mean, the first judge that I saw when I was going to the magistrate's court, well, when I first went to magistrate's court, we told the magistrate or the judge, I think it must have been a judge, but it's not a court that has a jury. And we said that I identify as Sven Longshanks because we didn't want my name or address to be put in the newspapers. And we thought, well, we'll use this transgender ideology and the rights that transgenders have to be referred to by the name that they choose. So we said, well, I go by the name Sven Longshanks. And they discussed this for a while and they came back and they said, okay, we'll refer to you as Mr. Longshanks. And then when the newspapers came out and wrote about it, they just put Sven Longshanks, formerly known as, and then they put my name in the newspapers. And then after that, in the magistrate's court, then I went to the Crown Court and it was basically just discussing things between my barrister and the prosecution barrister and the judge. And the judge there was absolutely furious. He said, I'm not referring to you as Mr. Longshanks. I'm not having you expounding your anti-Semitism in my court. And my barrister was saying, look, when they do these podcasts, you're going to have to hear the podcasts. And he's like, no, we're not having these podcasts. We're not having anti-Semitism and inciting hate in the court. And she just sort of had to be silent. And eventually they did decide that, yes, they would have to play the whole podcast because it's important you have the context. But she said, this is so wrong. This judge has already convicted you of guilt. She said, I've never seen anything like it. I don't know if he's playing up for the journalists that are sort of calling for my blood or what. And this judge was absolutely furious. And he had already judged me as being guilty. And then when it actually came to the court dates, he was unable to make those court dates. So I actually had a different judge, which I was very pleased about that I didn't have this first one. But yeah, he was quite open that he already thought that I was guilty. And the whole point of me being in the court is to argue my defence. So I'm hardly likely to be propagating anti-Semitic conspiracy theories in the court if I'm trying to prove that I'm not guilty of inciting hate, am I? That was the ridiculous thing. Now, this is what my barrister said. She said, I don't think he really understands what's going on here. But the law itself is years out of date anyway. It's not up to date with the internet age at all. I mean, I was prosecuted for publishing audio material. And I think at the time, it sort of meant if somebody was driving through a heavily black populated area with a loudspeaker, with offensive things coming out of this loudspeaker, trying to start a riot. And yet that was the law that they used against me. And since this law came out, the Public Order Act, which I think was the early 90s, early 90s, it's been the internet age since then. And things are different. And even when they did their reports on me to see how much of a risk I was, because it hadn't caught up to date with the internet, they considered me to be an extremely high risk because I had this excellent technological know-how of setting up a radio studio. Well, all you need today to do that is a smartphone and you're just talking to it. So when they did a second assessment of me, which was this new assessment that they've only just come out with, that they actually marked me down on it because of that fact that people now have the technology, you don't have to be a super technological whiz kid to set up a radio station. I mean, you have people that can do video hangouts and live video streams and set their own TV stations up now. So everything was very much out of date in the legal system as it is.
Okay, that's pretty interesting. And it's really interesting as to how subjective the laws in England had become. They're completely subjective on in this sphere of interest. These speech laws and laws of expression, they're completely subjective, and you're basically at the mercy of the feelings of the court when that happens. And the feelings of the jury.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, a lot of the stuff I was talking about, it happened, and the prosecution was alleging that it didn't happen, talking about the grooming gangs. And this person that was on the jury that kept voting not saying not guilty, he contacted me afterwards to say that he knew that what I was talking about was true because he was from Yorkshire. And it had come out in the local press what had happened with the grooming gangs, exactly what I was actually referring to, that they said was, you know, that didn't actually happen. And he knew that it did happen because he was from the area where it happened. And obviously, I think the way that I was talking about these things as well, obviously, you want people to be concerned about it. You want people to complain to their politicians and to create a ruckus about it. So you talk about these things in a way which is quite emotive. And of course, that plays against you in the court because they'll say, well, you're using this to try to get people really angry. And if they're really angry about this, they might go out and riot or they might go out and attack somebody. So that plays against you. So you have to, when you're talking about these things, you have to try and talk about them in less of an emotionally charged way. I mean, I don't really talk so much about black and white crime and those sorts of things now anyway. But back then I did, because this was from 2017 to 2019, the charges were from, and I was still publishing stuff at the Daily Stormer. up until halfway through 2017, I think it was. So it was just as we came out from doing Radio Aryan at the Daily Stormer to changing over to Radio Albion.
I just want to notice, I have a paper that I downloaded and saved from the UK Parliament, right, on grooming gangs. And this is actually something that went on in Parliament. And this Baroness Cox, I don't know who she is, right, except for this name, Baroness Cox, is addressing Her Majesty's government. And the purpose of this is a question to ask Her Majesty's government what progress has been made in the prevention of grooming gangs in Rotherham and elsewhere, and what assistance they have offered to victims and their families. And this is May of 2019, right? And she makes statements here. Child sexual exploitation occurs in many places. Some estimate grooming gangs operate in 73 towns, from Plymouth to Liverpool, from Cambridge to Glasgow. So is she in prison? Is Baroness Cox in prison? I need to know that. And she talks about their Pakistani heritage of these grooming gangs.
Well, they are predominantly Pakistani, and they're still tripping over themselves trying not to say that. When I went, when I was during this trial, one of the things that they said that was bad was that I was referring to illegal immigrants as invaders, and they said that this was threatening because you
every illegal immigrants.
Yeah, well, they said, well, you repel invaders. You're using this like violent term. And that same week, the Home Secretary Suella Braverman, she referred to it as an invasion. So she literally called the illegal immigrants invaders herself. And of course, since then, people have gone on to use that same terminology because they did it in the government. And also while I was in prison, or I think it was while I was on license, Elon Musk was pressuring Keir Starmer to have an investigation on the grooming gang scandal. And GB News took off as well. And they had a whole series on the grooming gangs. And they said there's at least 50 cities in the UK which have these grooming gangs in them. And there's all this pressure was put on the government to have a proper inquiry. So since that time, it's been massively in the news and it's become talked about all the time. And also the illegal immigrants are now being put in hotels. So there's been masses and masses of protests that are taking place outside these hotels because a certain portion of these illegal immigrants, they try to sexually assault the young girls, especially schoolgirls, and they'll try to record them. They'll try to crack onto them. There's been lots of cases where people have been arrested for that. And there's one infamous case last year that happened, and it was an Ethiopian, and he was found guilty of sexually assaulting this schoolgirl, and the prison service lost him. And he went to jail for a day or two, and then they let him out again. And then he was on the run, and then they sent him back to Ethiopia. But we still have people in prison now for complaining about that. So the people that complained about the Ethiopian sexually assaulting the schoolgirl, two of them were sent to prison for a longer time than the Ethiopian who sexually assaulted the schoolgirl was. And this is like mainstream news, and you hear about this stuff now. So things have changed since I was actually in there, and more people are talking about these issues and doing something about it. I mean, perhaps if my trial had taken place this year, perhaps I wouldn't have been found guilty on so many of the ones that I was found guilty on. But as I say, I was pleased that I beat them on five. And
that's
ten.
That's the cost of being a trailblazer.
Yeah, I guess.
It just is.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Well, the thing is, they were talking about this, you know, the BNP were talking about this in the early 2000s, and the BBC was saying that this doesn't happen. You know, Mark Ouellette was talking about it. Then a few years later, you had Tommy Robinson talking about it. And then in 2014, they said 1,400 schoolgirls have been, white schoolgirls have been raped by these grooming gangs just in Rotherham. And then it all came out. And this Labour MP, Sarah Champion, I think her name is, she said it could be up to 1 million schoolgirls have been raped by these Muslims. And that was a headline in the Daily Mirror. So it was all being talked about in 2014, And yet we've still got, as I say, a couple of years ago, 50 of these grooming gangs operating in 50 different cities. And yet this was all, it was all headline news in 2014. We're now in 2026. It's 12 years later. They haven't stopped this from going on. And they're still sending people to jail for talking about it. And they'll stand up in Parliament and say, we must not have people too frightened to report this. And it's terrible that these poor girls weren't believed. And yet they're still sending people to prison now for talking about it, for talking about it in the sort of way that a working class person might talk to his friends about issues like this. And it's all very well for them to say, well, you have to speak in this special coded BBC language. But the majority of the people in Britain don't speak in BBC coded language. They speak in the sort of language that they've been brought up with, in the cities or the towns where they live. And they're not intending on inciting violence or inciting hatred. They're just using the only terms that they have to discuss these issues. And I think that's why it is important that we have people like myself who make podcasts about these things, so that we can put it in terminology that people can use, and that they can use that when they're arguing, and then they'll know that they won't get sent to jail. I mean, GB News is very, very pro-Jewish, but one of the good things about it is that they will talk about these issues, and you can look at the way that they describe it and the terminology that they use. And if they're using this terminology, then it's okay for us to use this terminology. Things like saying the Indigenous Britons is quite a good one. And that's how Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg refers to the Indigenous Britons. So it's on the mainstream now. I was just looking the other day, and we've got a mainstream politician in Wales who's saying it's okay to be white, which is fantastic. I mean, there's been a big change, a sea change, really, over the last 2.5 years. And I know Donald Trump hasn't lived up to people's expectations, and he may not have done much for America. But one of the good things he has done is talk about the threat that mass immigration poses, and his administration. They send out tweets saying that the biggest threat to Europe is mass immigration. And unless something's done about it, Europe's going to collapse. And that the big threat isn't Russia. It's our own governments that are censoring the public who want to talk about these things. And this is sort of unheard of before, that you would get mainstream politicians talking about these issues. So there has been a huge change while I've been away that I'm very pleased with, and that I never could have foreseen either. When I was sent into prison, I never could have foreseen that Elon Musk would buy Twitter and you'd be back on their bill, and lots of other people would be back on there. I know some people are still banned who shouldn't be banned. But, I mean, he's retweeting things. My friend Sam Melia, he was also sent to jail for 2 years for stickers with immigration statistics on them. And Elon Musk has been retweeting that. So you've got the richest man in the world sending out retweets about people in Britain that have been jailed for thought crime. And I never would have thought that would have happened years ago. So, you know, it just tells you that you can have these big changes. And I'm not so big-headed to think that it's because of all our campaigning that this has happened. You know, I think it's, you know, if God wants things to change, he'll change things. You know, I don't think we can claim the credit for these things. They are massive changes that I really couldn't have foreseen. So as I say, I'm thankful to God for these changes, at least. You know, it seems to be making life a little bit better.
I've never been able to build really big social media accounts because I always get banned before I get started, right? I can't contain myself, and I always end up getting banned before I can get anywhere. That's just the way it is. It's always going to be that way. I think my John844X account has about 900 followers, but I've switched to my Christigenia X account, which I actually... It sat dormant for 7 years, and I revived it, and I think I have 700 followers, right? And I suspect 100 or 200 of them are probably dead because they haven't posted since COVID. So I'm about to weed all them out. Elon Musk, that the tide has been turning in some aspects at X. I still can't say anything I want. I mean, threatening people has always been against the law. And I don't do that, especially online. It's always been illegal. In every state in the United States, it's always been illegal, right? When I was young, I was in law enforcement, and there was a law on the books called terroristic threats that said, I'm going to go down to the avenue and kill all the whatever. Whatever group you don't like, you would be arrested. You could be arrested for that. And if they took your threat seriously, you could be in prison for that. So that's always been the case. Threats have always been, but to repel invaders, that's not a threat. They're invaders. They don't belong here. So you're talking about repelling them. They can't read your motivations. They can't read your mind or claim to read your mind. Once we claim that we could read someone's mind, we could make up anything we wanted about them. To repel them might simply mean to enforce the laws concerning immigration. So that's by itself, that's not a threat. That's insane.
Well, I don't tend to refer to them as invaders anyway, because I don't think we can call them invaders when our government is putting them up in hotels. It's like they're honored guests.
And they're trying to plug everything they see as a hole.
Yeah, they're literally just inviting them over, pretty much. I know that the Labour Party said that that's what they were going to do. They wanted to rub the right's nose in it, so they literally went out scouring the world to see anybody that wanted to come to Britain. They say, oh, well, they're not doing that now, but they're still putting people up in hotels. And as far as I can see...
Right? Good people don't have to do that. Good rulers don't have to do that. Their true character is a criminal nature. They have the criminal character.
Yeah, they do.
In order to prevent any resistance to their criminal agenda. That's the way I see it.
I think you might be fading in and out a little bit here, Bill. You went silent a bit there. Hopefully it will improve.
I'm sorry. I said that to me, that their desire to use these subjective laws and to claim that they could understand men's motivations for doing something, like saying repel invaders, that means you want to hurt illegal immigrants. No, how about repelling invaders simply by enforcing the immigration laws? So repelling invaders, wanting to repel invaders, isn't necessarily an expression of undue violence. It could be an expression to simply urge the government to enforce the laws. And that's perfectly legal. How could you tell me what I mean when I say repel invaders? You can't. You can't read my mind. So they believe that they could read your motivations and use these subjective laws to put you in prison. That simply means that, to me, that they're the criminals covering for their crimes in every way possible. They're the criminals, meaning the liberal establishment.
Well, I was meaning to be doing things legally, but what they were doing, or what the prosecution was doing, was he would pull things out from another podcast referring to something different and bring that up. And when it came to his bit when he was cross-examining me, he was like pulling a sentence from one podcast and putting it with a sentence from another podcast. And I was saying, look, I don't recall ever saying that. And he was like, oh, yes, you did. On this date, you said this bit. And on this date, you said that bit. But that's not me saying those two things together. And the content that I was making was aimed at nationalists. And it was very clear that it was nationalists making content aimed at nationalists. In fact, it said, if you're not a nationalist, you don't, this content isn't for you. It isn't intended for you. We might be saying things that you might find offensive. That's why we're talking to nationalists who already know about these things and who already use this sort of language. And so it was quite clear that I wasn't trying to make public propaganda. And yet elsewhere, we had talked about wanting to bring civic nationalists over to ethno-nationalism. And in another podcast, we were saying, well, this would be very good for bringing Sivnats over to ethno-nationalism. And because of that, they were saying, oh, yes, see, you're trying to bring civic nationalists into ethno-nationalism. Therefore, you are making propaganda. You are making propaganda for the whole public. You're not just making it for yourself. So they twist things. Even when it's quite open that we're not trying to talk to anybody else but ethno-nationalists, they'll try to turn things around and say that you are actually trying to do that. And that's one of the faults, really, of the British justice system, because the prosecutor is supposed to use anything he can lay his hands on to prosecute you. It's not about finding the truth. It's about prosecuting that person. And the defence is supposed to do the same. The defence is supposed to use anything they can legally lay their hands on to defend you. And then somewhere between those two sort of poles, they hope that you might get to what actually happened in the middle there. And that's just the way that the British justice system is, which I think is, it's not perfect, but it's still better than places in Europe where you have a public prosecutor, and the public prosecutor is also responsible for your defence. Whereas in Britain, you have a prosecutor and you have the defence, and they're supposed to use whatever they can to win the game. In actual fact, the judge was even referring to it as, at one point, he referred to it as a game or something like, let battle commence. So that's clearly how they look at it. It's not about actually getting to the truth or getting to what's right or wrong. It's about one or the other side winning. And that's the way that British justice is. So some of the things that the prosecutor was saying, I would think, well, that's below the belt, and that's, you know, that's not good that you're just twisting things around like that. But then your defence is supposed to do that as well. It's anything that's legally allowed, they are supposed to do. And in fact, if they don't do it, they would be negligent in their profession to not actually, if you can see what I mean, to not actually be doing it. I don't know how that compares with the American system, but that's why the prosecutor was doing these things. He was really only just doing his job. I mean, I did say good morning to him one morning because he's just doing his profession, and he's doing his profession to the best he can. In fact, I did get that sort of, I got that feeling from everybody there that they were very, very professional, and they were just trying to do their job as best as they can do it. And really, that's the best that you can ask for anybody in the justice system, is that they'll be professional, that they won't be biased towards you. And the judge himself was, you could see that he was trying to make these efforts to make things equal between the defence and also between the barrister as well. And when he was summing up, you could see that he was taking some care to try to be balanced in what he was doing. And that's the best that you can ask for. You can't expect the judge to say, I'm not going to send this person to prison because it's a free speech offence. He's got to go by these guidelines that he's got, that says that if this person is guilty, they've got to be given a minimum number of years. And then when I was found guilty, he said all these horrible things about me, which people were very upset about. But again, that was for the journalists that are there, because the journalists can't report on what I actually did say, because it was found to be incitement to hate. So to give an idea of how bad it was, the judge called me all these names at the end of the trial. But as I say, during the trial, he was fairly even-handed, or that's how it felt to me, especially after the first one that had already found me guilty before he'd even heard anything that I had to say. He was convinced that I was guilty, so that wasn't good. But as far as the actual people themselves were concerned, they did seem to be very professional. And that's the way that it should be. Things should be turned around the other way. And then the forces of the state should be used to protect the indigenous British people from things like this. And you would want them to be good at their job if the boot was on the other foot, if you see what I mean. And I like seeing it in America now, where the state apparatus is being used to go after illegal immigrants, and the state apparatus is being used to get rid of all these diversity and inclusion quotas and programs that they have in schools. And it's like the boot is on the other foot. It doesn't mean that I think people on the left should be censored, but I certainly don't think people on the right should be censored. And the state apparatus should be used for the benefit of the indigenous people, the people that created the state in the first place. And the way that we have things today, it's all to benefit people that actually aren't anything to do with the indigenous people. And we are, in actual fact, second-class citizens, because none of these hate speech laws will ever get used against anybody that isn't white. These incitement to hate laws, they are specifically used against white people, people on the right wing, nationalists. And that's, you know, that's the reason for having them. It's so that they can protect their narrative and ensure that people aren't criticizing it. And one of the ways I think that got proven as well was during COVID, because the same organizations that report on hate speech and put pressure on social media companies to silence people for hate speech were doing exactly the same thing for people that were talking about vaccinations and talking about health and talking about COVID-19. And talking about health and vaccinations, that's hardly inciting hatred against minorities, is it? And yet these same organizations were responsible for doing that, which to me, it was like, well, the mask has completely come off, hasn't it? They're not there to protect minorities from violence. They're there to protect whatever the government narrative is and to find whatever way they can to silence people from criticizing it.
Incredible. That's, I mean, I'd have to, I wouldn't know what parts of that have to be answered, but I don't have to say anything in response to that because it's all correct. It's a shame that yet you had to be a victim of it all, but that's just the chance that we take when we speak out as a dissident voice in our society. It goes with the territory. It's part of the price that we have to pay to get this message out. But I think that it's paying off with all of these recent mass scale anti-immigration rallies and marches we've seen throughout Britain and Ireland. I think it's paying off. It's if that's what it takes to raise people's awareness, that's not the solution. We don't have a political solution to our problems, but it's at least bringing many thousands of white folk together and giving them some sort of ethnic consciousness that their race and nation are endangered by this problem. And I think that might be the start to a greater awakening in the future. I really do.
Yeah, it seems that same way to me, that there is more and more people waking up to a racial consciousness and an ethnic consciousness. Conscious, yes, of the fact that they are an ethnicity and they do have legitimate interests, and that the group is being threatened by mass immigration. And the group that is threatening the indigenous people is the government. And it's what the government are doing. It's their policies that cause this. You can't blame Pakistanis for behaving like Pakistanis. You can't blame Jews for behaving like Jews, blacks for behaving like blacks. The people that you can blame are our elected representatives who are facilitating all of this and facilitating all of these problems, all these mass rape of all these schoolgirls. It would never have happened if it wasn't for our government's immigration policy of importing people that they knew would be likely to do that into our country. And you think about it, if you have an Islamic country where all the women are covered up and the women are wearing burqas all the time, and the men there aren't used to seeing women who aren't covered up in burqas, they come to Europe and it's like all the white women are running around naked. They're not covered up. You know, these Muslims, they're not used to seeing arms. They're not used to seeing flesh. So for them, it is literally like there are young white girls running around naked all over, yes, Europe. It's like Disneyland.
I agree.
For them. Yeah. And it's our government knew this. They know what it's like in these Islamic countries, and yet they still brought these people over here. Always have to try and make it quite clear that it is the government that is at fault. I mean, that's the truth. Now, I think if you're clear with that, then it's very difficult for people to say, oh, you're trying to incite hate against people because you hate the color of their skin.
Right. Not only do they bring them over, but they accommodate them. They allow them to keep their customs like burqas and things like that within our society, so the government is creating the alienation.
I think that's part of the reason why in places in Europe they will ban the burqa and things like that, because they think, well, if your women are wearing burqas, then they're looking down on the white women who aren't wearing the burqas, which is an argument. But another argument is, well, I want them to look as different as possible. The more different they look, the more ethnic consciousness is going to rise amongst our own people. So there's an argument for both cases, really.
Right. I mean, we really don't want the homogenization at all. We don't want them integrating into our society because they're an alien race. But it still makes the government hypocrisy even more apparent when they're allowed not only to come here, but to come here and be an alien colony hostile to our values inside of our society. Who does that? That's saying that you hate your own people and you're going to replace them with these people. That's what it is. Oh, that makes the replacement conspiracy, which really isn't a conspiracy, right? But they claim it is. But it makes it all the more apparent that it's true.
That's not a conspiracy, is it? It's the UN's stated purpose.
Yes.
Replacement migration.
Yeah. The media will still tell you it's a conspiracy.
They used the exact wording, replacement migration, in a UN paper some years back. And they said, well, the Europeans aren't producing enough to replace themselves. We'll have to have replacement migration from elsewhere. And that's what's happening. If you look in British hospitals, young mothers having babies, white babies, are only about 51%. So almost a minority already in our own country in the birthing wards, which means in 20 years' time, everybody, all the late teenagers, whites will be in a minority. You know, it's happening that fast, and people can see it now, and they're starting to wake up to it. I mean, when I was in prison, there were a lot of people there that were Labour supporters, a lot of left-wing people, but they were all concerned about immigration. They all couldn't understand what was happening, why the government was just bringing in loads of people from different racial groups. And they just couldn't understand it. Even people that were from some of these other groups couldn't understand it. You know, I was talking to Muslims and they were like, I don't understand why your government's doing all of this to you. And I was talking to them about the feminism as well. And they had noticed the way that the white man is being replaced on his television programs. He's always made out to be an idiot. You know, and I've got Muslims asking me this. Why is your, you know, why are you doing this to yourself? And it's like, it's not up to them to change things. It's up to white people to change things. And I can't expect them to change, but I can put pressure on white people and expect them to do things differently. You can change yourself, but you can't really change other people. And why, you know, why would you want to change these other people anyway? They're the way that they are. I think it's laughable, these people that try to change them. And that was one of the things why I probably got on all right with Muslims. I'm not somebody who wants to convert Muslims. I'm quite happy with them staying Muslims. Whereas there are a lot of civic nationalists that want to convert Muslims to being Christian. And if they just follow Christian precepts, everything will be fine. Of course, it won't be. And that's not natural for them anyway. They have their own religion and it works quite well in their own countries. But if they come over here to Britain, then it's not going to work very well, because in their own countries, if they thieve, they get their hands chopped off. You know, if they rape, they get hanged from a crane. If they come to Britain and they thieve, they're not even going to get sent to prison. So the temptation is there for them to do all these things. As I say, Europe is like a Disneyland. It's like a magnet for all the worst types from these other countries. Years ago, before I became a nationalist, I was in a Muslim country and I got on quite well with the street musicians because I used to play the drums and I was playing drums with them, basically. And I said, what is the diaspora of your people like? What is it like in Britain? And they said, don't have anything to do with them. They said, they're all the very, very worst people. All the people we don't want in our country, they leave and they go to yours because they're not welcome here in ours. He said, don't have anything to do with them. And that's come straight from the horse's mouth before I was even a nationalist. So Europe is quite clearly a magnet for all the worst elements from these other third world countries, from these Islamic countries. So it's, and our government knows that, and yet they still do what they do. They still put them up in hotels when they come over here. They pretend to be doing something about it. Clearly they're not. Boris Johnson, he was voted in on a stopping immigration ticket, and it was something like 1.2 million people came in under Boris Johnson. Legal immigration is more of a threat than illegal immigration is. But as I say, these are all negative things, but the positive side of that is that the more there is of this, the more white people are going to wake up to their own ethnicity, and you'll get more of a sense of solidarity among white people because of this.
I pray. It's going to take more than that to get our people to truly awaken to the fact that the only solution is repentance and to return to Christianity and embrace its values once again. All of this sodomy and everything else in society, all this other sin in society also has to be rejected. That's going to take perhaps a lot more doing than the ethnic consciousness awakening, which appears to be happening. I just don't know how this, I see a lot of the videos I have hundreds of them collected. I haven't posted them. I can't possibly post them all. I would like to post some of them soon at the Saxon Messenger site, but I just, it's not a priority, right? They're so ubiquitous in social media. It doesn't really matter anyway. It's all over TikTok. It's all over Facebook shorts and YouTube shorts, these demonstrations in Europe. And most of the people seem to be my age or older. I don't know how many young people are involved, and that's what it's going to take, because once these boomers are dead, I think our lives are going to be very different.
Well, you do hear that, you know, the Zoomer generation are supposed to be pretty based, and there have been studies that show that they're more leaning towards the right than they are to the left. I can imagine kids at school nowadays, they're going to hate all of this stuff. They're going to reject all of it when they're being targeted at school because they're white, and they're being told that they've got white privilege, and they see programs like this adolescence TV series that portrays all the white characters are in it are bad people, and the guy that stabs the girl is a white person, when knife crime is associated with black people more than it is white people. And I think kids seeing that, they can see that they're being targeted, and they're going to rebel against that. They're going to reject that. I haven't actually been to any protests since I finished my license, so I can't really comment on the age of the people that are at the protests. I haven't been able to do anything like that. I was banned from doing that because of my license restrictions. But also what I've been seeing on Twitter, there seems to be more and more young people, more and more women as well, that are making all these anti-immigration posts. I think the largest increase has come from women on there that I'm not used to seeing 3 years ago. And now it seems like every other tweet that's been sent out is by a woman with thousands of followers. I mean, part of it, me looks at it and says, well, I really don't agree with women sticking photos of themselves everywhere and then putting all these anti-immigration comments. Are they so into the anti-immigration, or are they just wanting lots of people to follow them because they're pretty? But even if it is just self-validation for them, it does show that it's now becoming acceptable to talk about these things. The very fact that women are making these posts shows that there's been a change, because years ago, or just a few years ago, they would be the ones shouting refugees are welcome here, and they would be supporting all of that line. And all you would see is male voices on Twitter saying anti-immigration things. But now it seems to be about 50-50. Again, that's another positive thing.
There's a dynamic in society among white males that shows that there is a serious sexual dysfunction with white males, that if I said something on X, things I've been saying for years, and I might get 70 reactions to it, sometimes 100 out of my 700 or 900 people on my followers list. If some blonde showing her cleavage on her profile picture said the same thing, she'd probably get tens of thousands of followers and likes and reactions. That's just the way it is. Look at that. There have been cases recently that this, what's her name? Shiloh. Here we have a blonde showing her cleavage and a blonde woman showing her, even though she's married, and she calls this black child a derogatory term. I'm not going to say it for your sake. And she raised $850,000 or something like that on Gibson Go to buy herself a new house and pay for her defense. And young white men had been in similar positions recently, like the one that wore the Nazi uniform to a Halloween party. It's a Halloween party. It's a costume party. I mean, you could go as Jack the Ripper, but you can't go as a Nazi. Well, he had all kinds of problems. I think he may have got drummed out of his school or whatever, and he had some real life consequences to what he did. But I looked at his Gibson Go page, and he raised hardly anything compared to Shiloh.
That's a shame. Prince Harry wore an SS uniform, didn't he? To fancy dress, must have been about 20 years ago. So 20 years ago, you could do that. When we had TV series over here, the TV series called Allo Allo, and it was about the French Resistance, and it lionized the French Resistance. But a lot of the comedy characters in it were National Socialists, and they're all dressed up in their National Socialist uniforms. And it was just seen as normal. That was the war from 60 or 70 years ago. And it's just a comedy based on the war.
I don't think that anybody actually thought Harry was a Nazi.
No, exactly. But what about this guy that dressed up in a uniform? I mean, he maybe had been watching Allo Allo, but that sort of thing was quite acceptable 20 years ago, and now it's not acceptable. I mean, I think that shows you the level of Jewish influence that there is in making these things unacceptable. If things just a few years back, you know, were you would expect to see that sort of thing at fancy dress, and now you don't. I mean, I can remember being at a fancy dress thing, I guess it was about 2005 at a festival, and there was one of my friends was there that I made at the festival that I used to meet at festivals, and he had like a huge beard on and a turban, and he was a mujahideen, and he'd come dressed as a mujahideen, and that was seen as acceptable. That was just seen as humorous. I'm not sure like how humorous that would be seen today if somebody was to turn up dressed as a suicide bomber at a festival fancy dress thing. But that was acceptable back then. A mujahideen, I think, is what he referred to himself as. But things do change. The social acceptabilities change over the years. And normally, if you're a traditionalist, you would try not to be moved by the way that these things change. But because of the laws that we have in Britain, you have to observe those changes unless you want to end up getting sent to jail. And I think one of the reasons why young people get caught out like this is because of listening to American podcasts. Because in American podcasts, you don't have the incitement to hate laws. So you've got language that people use. People then go on Twitter and they see, oh, you're a cuck if you don't use this term. If you're not going to refer to them as this, then you're a cuck. And then you've got British people that are fairly naive and they see that and, you know, they don't want to be mocked. So they're going to use that sort of language and they're going to say the same things. And before you know it, they're in jail. And every week it seems that you read about somebody who wasn't really connected to the nationalist scene, who was saying things on Twitter and getting likes for saying it. And yet they were breaking the UK speech codes and they get two years in prison. So that is another issue. I mean, it's great that we all speak English and American people support the British podcasts and British people support the Americans. But there is a difference in the laws. And you know, maybe it would help a bit if Americans sort of understood that a bit and didn't tease the British so much about them not using those sorts of terms. Because if you're in Britain and you use certain those terms, you could get sent to jail. Even saying things as milquetoast as some of the things that Jared Taylor says sometimes could possibly get you sent to jail in Britain. So that is another thing that I thought about while I was in prison. I was thinking, well, you know, there is this issue there with people thinking that laws in Britain are the same as in America. Maybe not so much now because there's been so many high profile cases of people being sent to jail for saying these things.
Well, I sent you a link to this parliamentary debate among these members of the House of Lords on grooming gangs. I sent that link to you in a private chat a few minutes ago, just so you'd have it. It's pretty interesting that this Baroness Cox, who's still a baroness to this day, even though she's 88 years old, right? She's still sitting in the House of Lords, I believe, and her and several others commended her. Lord Cormac, Lord Pearson of Rannoch, they commended her and mentioned her courage and things like that. And she actually connected this to people in certain vocations like taxi drivers and to Pakistanis. And these people are still sitting in the House of Lords. And this debate is still published on the page for the UK Parliament. So that's... It's incredible that if a commoner speaks about it, he goes to jail. But these lords are actually debating this and identifying the problems.
Yeah, that's actually written into law as well. They have what's known as parliamentary privilege. So they are able to say things that the general public are not allowed to say. And that's another thing that people might not actually be aware of. And it's called parliamentary privilege. Say there's a case which has been given a D notice or the press aren't allowed to talk about it. Well, it can be brought up by a politician. I think there was a recent case of this. It might have been to do with these Afghanis that got brought in. These Afghans all got brought into Britain secretly because a list of Afghan interpreters was made public. So they then said that these Afghans were all... going to be threatened by the Taliban. So they brought the masses of them over to Britain and they did it all secretly. And I think somebody used parliamentary privilege to talk about it and brought it up in Parliament.
But if you read the American Declaration of Independence, that double standard is exactly why the American colonies revolted from England.
They did the right thing.
That's why Thomas Jefferson wrote, "All men are created equal." Now, he didn't qualify it in the Declaration of Independence, which has really been a source of trouble to us because people read that out of context very commonly. But what he really meant, and this can be told from some of his personal letters and his other papers, is that all men are created equal in the eyes of the law.
You know, I always looked at that and I thought what it was saying is all white men are created equal because blacks were not actually seen as citizens at that time. And quite clearly, white people are different to blacks, aren't they? So I always thought what it was that because in America you had white people juxtaposed with black people, whereas before then you might have had Germans, you might have had French, you might have had English, you might as well say, oh, they're all different. But as soon as you put this other group there, as soon as you put this group of black men there, then white people are all equal to one another, even though they might be French, they might be German. So I think what he was referring to is like all white men are equal, just the same as all black men are equal. When you put them up against one another, if you just have all whites on their own, then you've got different types, haven't you? You've got European, you've got German, and that's the way that I always interpreted that.
Well, okay. He meant all men are created equal in the eyes of the law, but the fact that a man would be expected to be a white man, that's the historic context. That's a greater overarching historical context, okay? And the fact that that can be proven by the fact that first in the Constitution, which Jefferson had a part in influencing, he didn't write it. I think Madison primarily wrote it. But in the Constitution, slaves weren't even counted as people, right? That they were counted as two-thirds people only for the sake of representation, because the southern states were protesting that they had all these people and not enough representatives in Congress to balance things out and with the larger populations in the north, right? So they counted their slaves as two-thirds of a person, but that's not even a proof of the historical context, because it could be claimed that only refers to slaves. But the 1790 Naturalization Act of the United States Congress was that only free white men could become citizens of the United States. Free white persons. Congress, and this is the summary of the act that prefaces it, Congress first defined eligibility for citizenship by naturalization in this law and limited this important right to free white persons, okay? So that act was the law of the land during the period where Thomas Jefferson was president of the United States. Act was not changed for a long time.
Was it white men of good character, or just white men?
I would have to read the law itself and see. Any alien being a free white person who shall have resided within the limits and under the jurisdiction of the United States for the term of 2 years may be admitted to become a citizen thereof. On application to any common law court of record in one of the states wherein he shall have resided for the term of 1 year at least, and making proof to the satisfaction of such court that he is a person of good character. So there you have it.
Yeah, I knew there was a good character bit in there. I always thought that was good that they specified that. It's so important that you have good character. And I think my experience was character building. I've come out of it, and I think I'm improved to how I was than when I went in there. I was able to turn things around and turn it so that it benefited me, so that at the end of it, I have more things that I can do now than before I went in there. Lots of things about my life have improved while I was in there. So I
don't want to bug you for your personal issues, but you seem to be healthier.
Yeah, thank you. Well, a lot of people are saying that. I think I do look healthier.
You've gained some weight. Yeah. I mean, you were rather gaunt before. You were thin. you were always thin, I should say. In the pictures I saw of you, at least, now you look heavier and healthier.
Yeah, I'm healthier.
Your face is filled out.
I'm quite invigorated as well, and keen to get as much done as I possibly can during the day. I used to get lots done before, but I'm getting even more done now, and I like to keep myself busy and positive and creative. I think it's important that you keep creative. You know, I used to play the drums, and I stopped playing years ago due to injuries. And through injuries, I lost the ability to make my own testosterone. And when I lost the ability to make my own testosterone, I lost my love of music. I lost my sense of rhythm. And then I got treatment for that, and they finally diagnosed it that the problem was low testosterone. And I got treatment for that, I think, in 2017, and my love of music came back, and I started doing the music podcast, but I hadn't actually played any drums, because by that time I didn't have any drums at home. And then when I was in prison, they had an electronic drum kit, and I'd never played electronic drums before, and I got on this kit, and it all came back to me, just like riding a bike. And the teacher there was also a drum teacher, and he got me tutoring one of the other lads there who was doing his grade 2 drumming, because he could tell that I was a competent drummer. And I mean, I hadn't picked up sticks for a long time. And when I was playing, I stopped using sticks and taught myself to play hand drums instead, because the sort of music I liked didn't actually have, didn't use a drum kit. Like dance music, electronic dance music doesn't use a drum kit. So I was using hand drums, and I taught myself to play them, various different hand drums. So when I was in prison, I got back behind a kit using the drumsticks again, and I can remember thinking, like, how silly I was using these hand drums. You know, the white man uses tools. He uses tools. He doesn't use his hands. And I'm using these sticks again, and it all came back to me. And since then, I've got various different electronic percussion equipment that I'm playing. And my mother's quite overjoyed at that, because she was a music teacher, and my whole family are musical. And like, I hadn't been making music for a long time. And so I've come out of prison making music again, and really into music, and doing that every day as well. So, and that was like a large part of my character. I was always known as James the Drummer, and yet I hadn't been doing that for a long time. So that was like a massive improvement and a big boost to my life. And I wouldn't have been able to do that if I hadn't actually been in prison. And the other thing, because I was in prison and there were other prisoners there that might play the guitar or might play the keyboard, might be able to sing, they were in the music room as well. So I was like jamming with them. So I was going off to the college during the day and jamming with these other musicians, really buzzing. I was coming back from a day at college, like just smiling from ear to ear. I'd had a really great time. I'd come back and I'd get my dinner. They'd lock me in, and I'd watch Star Trek. And I used to like Deep Space Nine and Voyager, but I never got any further than the second series for some reason back in the 90s. So I had seven new series or the whole of the season of Deep Space Nine and Voyager to watch as well. So I would have my dinner and I would watch that. And then I'd get up again the next day and I'd go and play the drums again. And that it made a huge difference, I think. And even when I came to leaving the prison, I was like, well, you know, there is something that I'm actually going to miss. And that is being able to jam with all these other musicians, because once I'm out of there, obviously it's going to be difficult to find other musicians, difficult to find somewhere that you can, you know, that you can jam with them. And I was quite right. It's been quite difficult to find other people that I can sort of jam along with since I've come out of there. I end up playing along to DJ mixes that I've started doing as well, which I've got into doing. And, you know, that was really surprising. And, you know, that's why I say it does feel as if God was looking out for me. And because if I hadn't have been in there, I wouldn't have got back drumming again. And if I hadn't got back drumming again, I you know, that part would still be missing from my life. And it's very good to have it back. And it's good to be creative. I mean, I'm creative making podcasts, but I'm also creative with music as well. So that was a huge improvement. And obviously there's the health one as well. I don't really know why that is. I'm not really eating any differently than I was before. But for medical reasons, I wasn't able to eat any lunch. And I changed some of my medication, and now I'm able to eat lunch as well. So that's probably the reason for why I put the weight on. And that change with the medication was just a few months before the trial. So the effects of that weren't really felt until I was in prison and come out of prison. And the food wasn't that bad. In one of the prisons, it was absolutely awful. It was just French fries and a packet of cuppa soup or a packet of noodles. And that was it. And I was just really surviving on biscuits that I got from the canteen. And then I got moved to another prison, and the food there wasn't too bad at all. It was like chicken and chips, samosas, curry, rice, curry, things like that. And it wasn't too bad. And again, I think that was another reason why I seem to get on okay with Muslims, is because I don't eat pork. Obviously, Christian identity, I don't eat pork. I mean, it's logical not to eat pork when you learn about these things and you learn about swine meat. There's a religious side to it as well, that it's an unclean animal and you shouldn't eat unclean animals. Of course, Muslims were overjoyed when they would hear that I didn't eat pork. And okay, when they would complain about the smell of like spam being cooked up, you know, they would like look to me for approval to agree with them. Yeah, it was quite funny.
Yeah, you know, I could talk about prison stories all day, and I could tell you how many times I've seen black Muslims and Muslims of other races actually remove their Muslim headgear and the little kufis they were allowed to wear and things like that, and sneak into the white side of the chow hall and find a place to eat pork when they had pork on the menu. I've seen that hundreds of times.
They would have to avoid the other Muslims. They really would. I mean, one of the issues.
Yeah, well, that's why they would do that.
Yeah.
The chow hall was pretty big, right? It could probably seat 500, 600, 800 prisoners. I don't know. It was pretty big.
Yeah, they do have a way of sort of keeping order among them. I did hear from somebody else that was in jail, and he was sort of quite friendly with them as well. And he sort of came in at one point where one of them was being punished for doing that sort of thing, and he's been given like quite a serious punishment from like other elder Muslims like on the wing. So they do sort of keep control of them, and you know, that's probably
yes,
probably
I understand thing. That. Yes. I understand that. That's part of the prison mentality is to keep control of your own people in that other white guys or other Muslims or other Mexicans, yeah, to keep them in check, to don't let them misbehave so that your group isn't ashamed of your behavior, things like that. Yeah. Or you're not doing anything that threatens the wider group. So that's a prison gang mentality, right? That sort of happens almost naturally sometimes. But aside from all this, Sven, I have one hard question to ask you, okay? I hope you don't mind.
No, go on.
But with your going to prison and Sam Melia going to prison, and I believe other people related to the Patriotic Alternative organization in Britain going to prison for hate speech or whatever their accusation was, that the a lot of people in that I'm aware of have become very distrusting of Mark Collett. So I would like to give you an opportunity to state your opinion on that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, Mark is a really good guy. I've been working with him since 2017, quite closely working with him. We put on the first conference, which was the first PA conference, and then PA got announced to the world at that conference. And he said he would come and be a Radio Aryan host, but I'd have to change the name to Radio Albion, because he said the name, you're not going to be able to rehabilitate that name, and it's actually going to hold you back more than anything else. So he actually changed it to Radio Albion, and then it was a month after.
I'm just asking about Mark, because people have seen so many other people in Patriotic Alternative get in trouble, yet Mark seems to be unscathed.
Well, the thing is, I got arrested a month after changing the name from Radio Aryan to Radio Albion, and the charges were all from 2017 to 2019, and I didn't start working with Mark until 2019. Sorry, I said the wrong date there if I said 2017. It was 2019. That was when we did this conference together, and that was when I changed the name of Radio Aryan to Radio Albion. The conference was September, I think. And we changed the website in November, and then I got arrested in December for content that I'd made between 2017 and 2019. So before I started working with Mark, basically. And Sam Melia, he was arrested for content that he had made before he started working with Mark. The other guy, Chris Kearns, he used to be in National Action, and he had he was doing things, PE things, sports stuff, and he was to do with the sports side of PA, but I think he was living in Spain, and he had his own chat room, basically. It wasn't a PA chat room, and in there he had a link to a library, and one of the books in the library was Breivik's manifesto. And because this guy, Chris Kearney, used to be in National Action Prohibited Group, they were then able to prosecute him for having this terrorist manual on his chat room, and they pulled him back from Spain. Again, it was nothing whatsoever to do with Patriotic Alternative. PA have been really, really helpful. They raised a lot of money for me. They got loads of people writing to me. Mark's done the same for people that were arrested during the protests after Southport, and some of these protests turned into riots. and people that were sent to jail for things that they wouldn't have got sent to jail for if they were black, things like shouting at police or kicking the tire of a police van. PA have been helping them out as well. They've been raising funds for them, giving them funds. And Mark's way of doing things was, I mean, I think it was the right way to do things, really. He's obviously, CI is a religious thing, and what Mark does is a political thing. It's activism. And there are people that aren't actually white, which don't want to see Britain become non-white. It's not to their benefit. And they are supportive of PA. And Mark will reach out to people and will say, everybody's welcome. If you're against white genocide, if you want to support white people and you don't happen to be white, then I'm happy to accept your support. And his argument is that, you know, we've got people that are white that will stab us in the back, that are total liberals. And then you've got some people that aren't white, but they are actually sympathetic to the things that we are sympathetic to, and they make good allies. And again, you know, it's good for the propaganda. You know, we're not anti these people. What we're against is our government's policies and swamping the country with people like that. So that was his way of doing things. And I can remember having a bit of an argument with him, really. Not an argument, but a disagreement when we were first putting the first conference on. And I was saying, well, everybody there should be white. It has to be everybody there is white, because if everybody there is white, there'll be like a certain vibe. And that was when he said, well, the issue is you might have people that aren't white that are supportive, and you might have people that are white who are not supportive. And I think it would be better if we just said to anybody that is supportive of us can come along. And I think he was right in saying that. And I sort of deferred to his experience, because he had 20 years of experience in nationalism. So I thought, well, I'll see what you do, see whether that's right. The other choice he made was that Laura Towler would be his deputy. And people were saying, how can you have a female as your deputy? How can you do that? And again, that's turned out to be a fantastic choice. She's been a brilliant second in command. She's done really, really well. And that was a really good choice that he made there. It was the right choice. And I think he made the right choice as well when he said, look, we can't have this as a whites only event. Number one, because that's illegal in Britain. You cannot do that. They would say that you are excluding people on racial grounds. That's the equivalent of incitement to hate. So number one is the legal factor in that. And the second thing, again, is because people can then see that he's not anti these other people from these other groups. What he's against is the government policy of immigration. And he will support nationalists from whatever group they're from. In fact, I've got a good quote here. Maybe I left it in the other room. I've got a really good quote from Cornelia Codrianu, the Romanian nationalist. And it was talking about the fact that other nationalists, you might have other nationalists from other ethnicities, but they're essentially involved in the same struggle. They're just trying to do what's right for their people. And if you're trying to do what's right for your people, then, you know, you have my support. You're not my enemy. And I can understand what you're doing, even if you might come across with different at odds with some of the policies that I might have. At least I can understand that you're trying to do your best for your people. And that is the right way to be. That is how every group should be doing what's best for that group. And you can't really criticize people from these other groups if that's what they're doing. You can criticize them if they're traitors, but not traitors to white people, because they're not white. They would be traitors to their own people. So I have a very high opinion of Mark, and he's a friend as well as a colleague. And I know how it looks with various people getting arrested, and it really hit PA hard as well, because people were seeing that people from PA were being sent to jail, and people then didn't want to join PA. And instead of like cutting us off and saying, oh, yes, well, we're nothing to do with PA, we've been sent to prison, Mark has like stood by everyone that's been sent to jail like the whole time. And as I say, in every instance, it's been for things that people did before they joined PA. The other one was James Costello, and he was prosecuted for doing stuff with the Church of Creator. I forget the guy's name. I have a very low opinion of him. Not James Costello. I have a very high opinion of James Costello. He came and supported me at my trial. He was there to support me. I have a low opinion of the guy that founded that Church of the Creator, but it was that content that he was prosecuted for. Again, it was nothing whatsoever to do with Mark and nothing to do with PA. So maybe that answers your question, Bill. You got any comments?
Yes, it does. I'm just glad to get your side of that story out to our community, because people at Christianity do have questions about Mark, and I wanted to get your opinions, and that's fine. So that's good. I appreciate that. I value that. And as for Anders Breivik, I don't know why any white nationalist would have anything to do with Anders Breivik. And that's because I wrote an article about this shortly after the shooting in, this is dated August 14th, 2011, when I posted this at Christigenia. And I had written it for a Saxon Messenger edition that I published that same month. The, Anders Breivik was a Freemason and a Zionist, and the people that he shot were actually part of the Boycott Israel movement in Scandinavia, in Norway. And this movement, these Scandinavians had been calling for boycotting Israel that long ago and even longer. And they're the people he shot. So yeah. He was basically shooting white people because they wanted to boycott Israel. Anders Breivik isn't the man he's made out to be. You're not anti-immigration or pro-white and go shooting up 80-something white people. No, I don't accept that at all.
Yeah, it wasn't Chris Kearney or Charlie Big Potatoes, as his internet name was. It wasn't him supporting Anders Breivik. It was the library link that he linked to that had all sorts of documents on there and books. One of the books that was on there was Breivik's manifesto, which he wasn't even aware that it was on there. That's why he was prosecuted. And just another point, I mean, I can remember when I started being able to listen to Christigenia again. I think on a podcast you mentioned this, and you mentioned about Mark. And I think you may have getting him mixed up with Alex Davies. Alex Davies was the leader of National Action. And on some of the podcasts that I was prosecuted for, he was my co-host. And he had said some things in those podcasts which were unwise, shall we say. He was talking about these protests that took place in Rotherham after the grooming gang scandal. And I was saying, and of course, all these white people went wild beating up Pakistanis and throwing bricks through windows, didn't they? Expecting him to say, well, of course not. And he laughed and said, oh, well, I wish. No, of course they didn't. And because he said that, they said, well, he was quite clearly, he was unhappy that the white people didn't riot and he would like to see white people attacking brown people. And I was saying, well, no, I don't think he was saying that. He was just making a joke out of it. But again, that was one of these reasons. I think one of the reasons they may have gone after me so much is because I had Alex Davies as my co-host. And at the time, National Action had got banned and they hadn't been doing anything for about a year and a half. And Alex promised me that he had nothing to do with National Action, that he wasn't under arrest, that he wasn't under investigation or anything like that. And I said, well, why don't you come on and co-host with me? Because I knew that he had a good knowledge of politics and he would be good at making comments on political issues. And I said, and then you can show to the police that what you're doing is nothing to do with what you were doing in National Action. You're not doing flash demonstrations or taking photos places. You're just giving commentary on podcasts. And that was something that nobody from National Action had done. They'd done interviews, but none of them had been co-hosts on podcasts. It wasn't something that they did. So I said, well, if you come and work with me for a while and make these podcasts, you can say, look, this is what I've been doing. I'm not doing anything similar to National Action. And so we made about a dozen podcasts together. And then he stopped. And three or four of the podcasts that I was prosecuted for are the ones that I did with Alex. So, I mean, looking back on that, maybe it was unwise for me to start making podcasts with him, considering what had happened to his previous organization. But it may be that people might have got that mixed up with Mark and thinking it might have been Mark that was making these comments on my podcast, but it wasn't. It was Alex Davies. So just to clear that point up as well.
Okay, that's interesting. I think that's highly unfortunate that there is no true freedom of speech in Britain or in Europe. It's sad. Threats have always, as I said before, been against the law. And if I started preaching that we go out and do injury to certain groups that we just happen not to like, well, I would expect to be investigated and probably face prison time. But we don't do that, and we're not about that. So we've spoken about the reasons for that already. I'm not going to repeat them, but it's just unfortunate that we have to, at least many of us in Europe especially, have to basically walk across glass to try to get appeal to our people and preach to them any sort of common sense geared towards our own survival as nations.
Well, that is another thought that came to me while I was in prison. I was thinking, well, you know, they're saying to us we have to speak in this certain form of language. But if we do speak in that certain form of language, then it means our content is more accessible. It means that we're not just reaching out to nationalists. It means we can reach out to anybody because our message is reasonable and we're saying it in language which isn't designed to inflame emotions. And therefore, it's actually going to reach more people. So,
they would change the rules.
Yeah. But they haven't changed them yet.
They would just shift the goalpost again.
They haven't done that yet. But yes, I would expect them to. I mean, that's I think what they call this legal but harmful is this other terminology that they've tried to bring in along with the Online Safety Act, where somebody from the government can decide that even though something's completely legal, they think that it might be harmful for people to hear, so they can demand that an American social media company remove those posts. So they are already trying to move in that direction, but that's not law yet. So again, you can turn it around. And obviously, you've got no compulsion to obey. You're not under any compulsion to obey British law. You just have to obey American law, Will, which I know you're very careful to observe.
At least in America, it's pretty much common sense what's right and wrong, right? I mean, a threat's a threat, and they're all against the law. You just don't threaten anybody. You have every right to criticize their character or to criticize them, and as long as you're not slandering them, it's totally legal. It's within our right to be able to do that.
That's the right way to be. That is the right way to be. I mean, I think that's very, very sensible. It used to be the same way in Britain. And I know that a lot of America's laws and the freedom of speech in America comes from the freedom of speech that there was in Britain. But that all started changing. I think around about the 40s, the 1940s, there have been various other amendments. And now we have this Public Order Act, which is the main one, which I think came about in the 90s. That is, that's the main one that people get charged under. That's the one that I was charged under. But they also have this malicious communications, which they've started using as well. But it should just be threats, incitement to violence, and it should be specific violence, a specific target, and that should not be allowed. But as far as using whatever terminology you want to use to refer to somebody, that should be your right to use whatever terminology you want. But again, if you use that terminology, you might be making your content less accessible. And there might be people that would really like to hear what you have to say, really need to hear what you say, but they might not be able to listen to it because they might get turned off because of the sort of terminology you're using. So, I mean, I nowadays try to use the least offensive language that I possibly can and try to see things from all points of view. Because I think, apart from that being the right way to be, being objective, I think it's going to get more people to be able to access it and to listen to it.
That's I guess that's the line that you have to toe, and I just appreciate your resolve and your willingness to go right back into this arena after suffering what you've done, what's happened to you. And I think that's commendable.
Well, you have to get back on the bike again when you fall off, don't you? You know, that's...
Yes.
That's the way it is.
Otherwise, you don't get home.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a long walk. Yeah.
That's right.
I agree. Thank you, Sven. I know that we're already over the time that you had desired. Thank you very much for being here. And I hope that this is informative and helps some of our people in Britain down the road.
I'm sure it will. Thank you very much for inviting me on, Bill. It's always good to talk to you, and I always enjoyed the podcast we made before. So, yeah, it's been a very pleasant afternoon for me talking to you again and talking to your listeners. Thank you.
We didn't get to your Bible questions. No. I know you actually did spend some time reading the Bible while you were away, and I hope to do that again with you in the near future.
Yeah, I'd enjoy that, yes.
We'll work that out. Thank you, Sven. Thank you for being here. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel. And I'm going to end the recording now.
RadioAlbion.com